Clattering down two steps at a time, he morosely continued his descent. Too late now to change his mind. When he reached ground level, he found himself confronted by a large lobby, including a marble-topped table, very long, on which two ceramic vases of flowers, evidently iris, rested. Four wide steps led down to the curtained front door. He grasped the faceted glass knob of the door and swung it open. More steps. And on the right, a row of locked brass mailboxes, each with a name, each requiring a key. He had been right. This was as far as the mail was brought. He located his own box, finding a strip of paper at the bottom of it reading Joseph Chip, 2075, plus a button which, when pressed, evidently rang upstairs in his conapt. The key. He had no key. Or did he? Fishing in his pockets, he discovered a ring on which several diversely shaped metal keys dangled. Perplexed, he studied them, wondering what they were for. The lock on the mailbox seemed unusually small. Obviously, it took a similar size key. Selecting the most meager key on the ring, he inserted it in the lock of the mailbox, turned it. The brass door of the box fell open. He peered inside. Within the box lay two letters and a square package wrapped in brown paper, sealed with brown tape. Purple 3-cent stamps with a portrait of George Washington. He paused to admire these unusual memorabilia from the past, and then, ignoring the letters, tore open the square package, finding it rewardingly heavy. But, he realized suddenly, it's the wrong shape for a spray can. It's not tall enough. Fear touched him. What if it was not a free sample of Ubik? It had to be. It just had to be. Otherwise, Al, all over again.
Mars certa et horas certa,
he said to himself as he dropped the brown paper wrappings and examined the pasteboard container within. Ubik liver and kidney balm. Inside the container, he found a blue glass jar with a large lid. The label read, Directions for Use. This unique analgesic formula, developed over a period of 40 years by Dr. Edward Sonderbar, is guaranteed to end forever annoying getting up at night. You will sleep peacefully for the first time, and with superlative comfort. Merely dissolve a teaspoon of Ubik liver and kidney balm in a glass of warm water and drink immediately 1/2 hour before retiring. If pain or irritation persists, increase dosage to 1 tablespoonful. Do not give to children. Contains processed oleander leaves, saltpeter, oil of peppermint, N-acetyl-P-aminophenol, zinc oxide, charcoal, cobalt chloride, caffeine, extract of digitalis, steroids in trace amounts, sodium citrate, ascorbic acid, artificial coloring and flavoring. Ubik liver and kidney balm is potent and effective if handled as per instructions. Inflammable. Use rubber gloves. Do not allow to get in eyes. Do not splash on skin. Do not inhale over long periods of time. Warning. Prolonged or excessive use may result in habituation.
This is insane, Joe said to himself.
He read the list of ingredients once more, feeling growing, baffled anger, and a mounting helpless sensation that took root and spread through every part of him.
I'm finished, he said to himself. This stuff isn't what Runciter advertised on TV. This is some arcane mixture of old-time patent medicines, skin salves, painkillers, poisons, inert nothings, plus, of all things, cortisone, which didn't exist before World War II. Obviously, the Ubik which he described to me in the tape TV commercial, this sample of it anyhow, has reverted. An irony that is just plain too much. The substance created to reverse the regressive change process has itself regressed. I should have known as soon as I saw the old purple 3-cent stamps.
He looked up and down the street and saw, parked at the curb, a classic museum piece surface car, a LaSalle.
Can I get to Des Moines in a 1939 LaSalle automobile?
He asked himself.
Eventually, if it remains stable, perhaps a week from now. But by then it won't matter. And anyhow, the car won't remain stable, Nothing, except maybe my front door, will.
However, he walked over to the LaSalle to examine it at close range.
Maybe it's mine, he said to himself. Maybe one of my keys fits its ignition. Isn't that how surface cars operated? On the other hand, how am I going to drive it? I don't know how to pilot an old-time automobile, especially one with, what do they call it? Manual transmission.
He opened the door and slid onto the seat behind the driver's steering wheel. There he sat, plucking aimlessly at his lower lip and trying to think the situation through.
Maybe I ought to drink down a tablespoon of Ubik liver and kidney balm, he said to himself grimly. With those ingredients, it ought to kill me fairly thoroughly.
But it did not strike him as the kind of death he could welcome. The cobalt chloride would do it, very slowly and agonizingly, unless the digitalis managed it first. And there were, of course, the oleander leaves. They could hardly be overlooked. The whole combination would melt his bones into jelly, inch by inch.
Wait a minute, he thought. Air transportation existed in 1939. If I could get to the New York airport, possibly in this car, I could charter a flight, rent a Ford tri-motor plane complete with pilot. That would get me to Des Moines.
He tried his various keys and at last found one which switched on the car's ignition. The starter motor cranked away, and then the engine caught. With a healthy rumble, the engine continued to turn over, and the sound of it pleased him. Like the genuine cowhide wallet, this particular regression struck him as an improvement. Being completely silent, the transportation of his own time lacked this palpable touch of sturdy realism.
Now, the clutch, he said to himself. Over on the left.
With his foot, he located it.
Clutch down to the floor, then shift the lever into gear.
He tried it, and obtained a horrid clashing noise, metal whirring against metal. Evidently, he had managed to let up on the clutch. He tried it again. This time, he successfully got it into gear. Lurching, the car moved forward. It bucked and shuddered, but it moved. It limped erratically up the street, and he felt within him a certain measured renewal of optimism.
And now let's see if we can find the goddamn airfield, he said to himself, before it's too late, before we're back to the days of the gnome rotary engine with its revolving outside cylinders and its castor oil lubricant. Good for 50 miles a hedge-hopping flight at 75 miles per hour.
An hour later, he arrived at the airfield, parked and surveyed the hangars, the windsock, the old biplanes with their huge wooden props.
What a sight,
he reflected. An indistinct page out of history. Recreated remnants of another millennium, lacking any connection with the familiar, real world. A phantasm that had drifted into sight only momentarily. This, too, would be gone soon. It would no more survive than had contemporary artifacts. The process of devolution would sweep this away like it had everything else. He got shakily from the LaSalle, feeling acutely carsick, and trudged toward the main buildings of the airfield.
What can I charter with this?
He asked, laying all his money out on the counter before the first official-looking person he caught sight of.
I want to get to Des Moines as quickly as possible. I want to take off right away.
The field official, bald-headed, with a waxed mustache and small, round, gold-rimmed eyeglasses, inspected the bills silently.
Hey, Sam, he called with a turn of his apple-like round head. Come here and look at this money.
A second individual, wearing a striped shirt with billowing sleeves, shiny seersucker trousers, and canvas shoes, stumped over.
Fake money, he said after he had taken his look.
Play money. Not George Washington and not Alexander Hamilton.
Both officials scrutinized Joe.
Joe said, I have a 39 LaSalle parked in the parking lot. I'll trade it for a one-way flight to Des Moines on any plane that'll get me there. Does that interest you?
Presently, the official with the little gold-rimmed glasses said, meditatively,
Maybe Augie Brent would be interested.
Brent?
The official in the seersucker pants said, raising his eyebrows.
You mean that Jenny of his? That plane's over 20 years old. It wouldn't get to Philadelphia.
How about McGee?
Sure, but he's in Newark.
Then maybe Sandy Jesperson. That Curtis Wright of his would make it to Iowa, sooner or later.
To Joe, the official said,
go out by Hangar 3 and look for a red and white Curtis biplane. You'll see a little short guy, sort of fat, fiddling around with it. If he don't take you up in it, nobody here will, unless you want to wait till tomorrow for Ike McGee to come back here in his Fokker trimotor.
Thanks, Joe said, and left the building. He strode rapidly toward Hangar 3, already seeing what looked like a red and white Curtis Wright biplane.
At least I won't be making the trip in a World War JN training plane, he said to himself.
And then he thought,
how did I know that Jenny is a nickname for a JN trainer? Good God, he thought. Elements of this period appear to be developing corresponding coordinates in my mind. No wonder I was able to drive to LaSalle. I'm beginning to phase mentally with this time continuum in earnest.
A short, fat man with red hair puttered with an oily rag at the wheels of his biplane. He glanced up as Joe approached.
Are you Mr. Jesperson?
Joe asked.
That's right.
The man surveyed him, obviously mystified by Joe's clothes, which had not reverted.
What can I do for you?
Joe told him.
You want to trade a LaSalle, a new LaSalle, for a one-way trip to Des Moines?
Jesperson cogitated, his brows knitting.
Might as well be both ways. I got to fly back anyway. Okay, I'll take a look at it. But I'm not promising anything. I haven't made up my mind.
Together they made their way to the parking lot.
I don't see any 39 LaSalle.
Jesperson said suspiciously. The man was right. The LaSalle had disappeared. In its place, Joe saw a fabric-top Ford coupe, a tinny and small car, very old, 1929, he guessed. A black 1929 Model A Ford, nearly worthless. He could tell that from Jesperson's expression. Obviously, it was now hopeless. He would never get to Des Moines. And, as Runciter had pointed out in his TV commercial, this meant death. The same death that had overtaken Wendy and Al. It would be only a matter of time.
Better, he thought, to die another way. Ubik, he thought.
He opened the door of his Ford and got in. There, on the seat beside him, rested the bottle which he had received in the mail. He picked it up. And discovered something which did not really surprise him. The bottle, like the car, had again regressed. Seamless and flat, with scratch marks on it, the kind of bottle made in a wooden mold. Very old indeed. The cap appeared to be handmade, a soft tin screw type dating from the late 19th century. The label, too, had changed. Holding the bottle up, he read the words printed on it.
Elixir of Ubique. Guaranteed to restore lost manliness and to banish vapors of all known kinds, as well as to relieve reproductive complaints in both men and women. A beneficent aid to mankind when sedulously employed as indicated.
And in smaller type, a further inscription. He had to squint in order to read the smudged, minute script.
Don't do it, Joe. There's another way. Keep trying. You'll find it. Lots of luck. Runciter, he realized. Still playing his sadistic cat-and-mouse games with us, goading us into keeping going a little longer, delaying the end as long as possible. God knows why. Maybe, he thought, Runciter enjoys our torment. But that isn't like him. That's not the Glenn Runciter I knew.
However, Joe put the elixir of Ubique bottle down, abandoning the idea of making use of it. And wondered what Runciter's elusive, hinted at, other way might be. 11.
Taken as directed, Ubique provides uninterrupted sleep without morning after grogginess. You awaken fresh, ready to tackle all those little annoying problems facing you. Do not exceed recommended dosage.
Hey, that bottle you have,
Jesperson said.
He peered into the car, an unusual note in his voice.
Can I look at it?
Joe Chip wordlessly passed the aviator the flat bottle of elixir of ubique.
My grandmother used to talk about this,
Jesperson said, holding the bottle up to the light.
Where'd you get it? They haven't made this since around the time of the Civil War.
I inherited it, Joe said.
You must have. Yeah, you don't see these handmade flasks anymore. The company never put out very many of these in the first place. This medicine was invented in San Francisco around 1850. Never sold in stores. The customers had to order it made up. It came in three strengths. This, what you have here, this is the strongest of the three.
He eyed Joe.
Do you know what's in this?
Sure, Joe said. Oil, peppermint, zinc oxide, sodium citrate, charcoal.
Let it go.
Jesperson interrupted. Frowning, he appeared to be busily turning something over in his mind. Then, at last, his expression changed. He had come to a decision.
I'll fly you to Des Moines in exchange for this flask of elixir of ubique. Let's get started. I want to do as much of the flying as possible in daylight.
He strode away from the 29 Ford, taking the bottle with him. 10 minutes later, the Curtiss Wright biplane had been gassed, the prop manually spun, and with Joe Chip and Jesperson aboard, it began weaving an erratic, sloppy path down the runway, bouncing into the air and then collapsing back again. Joe gritted his teeth and hung on.
We're carrying so much weight,
Jesperson said without emotion. He did not seem alarmed. The plane at last wobbled up into the air, leaving the runway permanently behind. Noisily, it droned over the rooftops of buildings on its way west. Joe yelled,
How long will it take to get there?
Depends on how much tailwind we get. Hard to say. Probably around noon tomorrow if our luck holds out.
Will you tell me now?
Joe yelled.
What's in the bottle?
Gold flakes, suspended in a base composed mostly of mineral oil,
the pilot yelled back.
How much gold? Very much?
Jesperson turned his head and grinned without answering. He did not have to say. It was obvious. The old Curtiss Wright biplane blurped on, in the general direction of Iowa. At 3 in the afternoon the following day, they reached the airfield at Des Moines. Having landed the plane, the pilot sauntered off for parts unknown, carrying his flask of gold flakes with him. With aching, cramped stiffness, Joe climbed from the plane, stood for a time rubbing his numb legs, and then unsteadily headed toward the airport office, as little of it as there was.
Can I use your phone?
He asked an elderly, rustic official who sat hunched over a weather map, absorbed in what he was doing.
Have you got a nickel?
The official, with a jerk of his colic head, indicated the public phone. Joe sorted through his money, casting out all the coins which had Runciter's profile on them. At last he found an authentic Buffalo nickel of the period and laid it before the elderly official. The official grunted without looking up. Locating the local phone book, Joe extracted from it the number for the Simple Shepherd Mortuary. He gave the number to the operator, and presently his party responded.
Simple Shepherd Mortuary, Mr. Bliss speaking.
I'm here to attend the services for Glenn Runciter, Joe said. Am I too late?
He prayed silently that he was not.
Services for Mr. Runciter in progress right now,
Mr. Bliss said.
Where are you, sir? Would you like us to send a vehicle to fetch you?
He seemed fussily disapproving.
I'm at the airport, Joe said.
You should have arrived earlier,
Mr. Bliss chided.
I doubt very much if you'll be able to attend any of the service. However, Mr. Runciter will be lying in state for the balance of today and tomorrow morning. Watch for our car, Mr.
Chip, Joe said.
Yes, you've been expected. Several of the bereaved have asked that we maintain a vigil for you, as well as for Mr. Hammond and a...
He paused.
A Miss Wright. Are they with you?
No, Joe said. He hung up, then seated himself on a curved, polished wooden bench where he could watch cars approaching the airport.
Anyhow, he said to himself, I'm here in time to join the rest of the group. They haven't left town yet, and that's what matters.
The elderly official called,
Mister, come over here a sec.
Getting up, Joe crossed the waiting room.
What's wrong?
This nickel you gave me?
The official had been scrutinizing it all this time.
It's a Buffalo nickel,
Joe said.
Isn't that the right coin for this period?
This nickel is dated 1940.
The elderly official eyed him unblinkingly. With a groan, Joe got out his remaining coins, again sorted among them, and at last found a 1938 nickel and tossed it down before the official.
Keep 'em both,
he said, and once more seated himself on the polished, curved bench.
We get counterfeit money every now and then,
the official said. Joe said nothing. He turned his attention to the semi-highboy Audiola radio playing by itself off in a corner of the waiting room. The announcer was plugging a toothpaste called Epana.
I wonder how long I'm going to have to wait here,
Joe asked himself. It made him nervous now that he had come so close physically to the inertials.
I hate to make it this far, he thought, within a few miles, and then
he stopped his thoughts at that point and simply sat. Half an hour later, a 1930 Willis Knight 87 putt-putted onto the airfield's parking lot. A hempen homespun individual wearing a conspicuously black suit emerged and shaded his eyes with the flat of his hand in order to see into the waiting room. Joe approached him.
Are you Mr. Bliss?
He asked.
Certainly, I am.
Bliss briefly shook hands with him, meanwhile emitting a strong smell of sensen, then got back at once into the Willis Knight and restarted the motor.
Come along, Mr. Chip. Please hurry. We may still be able to attend a part of the service. Father Abernathy generally speaks quite a while on such important occasions as this.
Joe got into the front seat beside Mr. Bliss. A moment later, they clanked onto the road leading to downtown Des Moines, rushing along at speed, sometimes reaching 40 miles an hour.
You're an employee of Mr. Runciter?
Bliss asked.
Right, Joe said.
Unusual line of business that Mr. Runciter was in. I'm not quite sure I understand it.
Bliss honked at a red setter which had ventured onto the asphalt pavement. The dog retreated, giving the Willis Knight its pompous right of way.
What does psionic mean? Several of Mr. Runciter's employees have used the term.
Parapsychological powers, Joe said. Mental force operating directly without any intervening physical agency.
Mystical powers, you mean? Like knowing the future? The reason I ask that is that several of you people have talked about the future as if it already exists. Not to me. Well, they didn't say anything about it except to each other, but I overheard. You know how it is. Are you people mediums? Is that it?
In a manner of speaking?
What do you foresee about the war in Europe?
Joe said, Germany and Japan will lose. The United States will get into it on December 7, 1941. He lapsed into silence then, not feeling inclined to discuss it. He had his own problems to occupy his attention.
I'm a Shriner myself,
Bliss said.
What is the rest of the group experiencing?
Joe wondered.
This reality? The United States in 1939? Or when I rejoin them, will my regression be reversed, placing me at a later period? A good question.
Because, collectively, they would have to find their way back 53 years to the reasonable and proper form constituents of contemporary, unregressed time. If the group as a whole had experienced the same amount of regression as he had, then his joining them would not help him or them, except in one regard. He might be spared the ordeal of undergoing further world decay. On the other hand, this reality of 1939 seemed fairly stable. In the last 24 hours, it had managed to remain virtually constant. But, he reflected,
that might be due to my drawing nearer to the group.
On the other hand, the 1939 jar of Ubik liver and kidney balm had reverted back an additional 80-odd years. From spray can to jar to wooden mold bottle within a few hours.
like the 1908 cage elevator which Al alone had seen. But that wasn't so. The short, fat pilot, Sandy Jespersen, had also seen the wooden mold bottle, the elixir of Ubique, as it had become, finally. This was not a private vision. It had, in fact, gotten him here to Des Moines. And the pilot had seen the reversion of the LaSalle as well. Something entirely different had overtaken Al, it would seem. At least, he hoped so, prayed so.
Suppose, he reflected, we can't reverse our regression. Suppose we remain here the balance of our lives. Is that so bad?
We can get used to 9-tube screen grid highboy Philco radios, although they won't really be necessary inasmuch as the super heterodyne circuit has already been invented.
Although I haven't as yet run across one.
We can learn to drive American Austin motor cars selling for $445, a sum that had popped into his mind seemingly at random, but which he intuited was correct.
Once we get jobs and earn money of this period, he said to himself, we won't be traveling aboard antique Curtiss Wright biplanes. After all, 4 years ago in 1935, Trans-Pacific service by four-engine China Clippers was inaugurated. The four trimotor is an 11-year-old plane by now. To these people, it's a relic, and the biplane I came here on is, even to them, a museum piece. That LaSalle I had before it reverted was a considerable piece of machinery. I felt real satisfaction driving it.
What about Russia?
Mr. Bliss was asking.
In the war, I mean. Do we wipe out those Reds? Can you see that far ahead?
Joe said,
Russia will fight on the same side as the USA. And all the other objects and entities and artifacts of this world,
he mulled.
Medicine will be a major drawback. Let's see. Just about now they should be using the sulfa drugs. It's going to be serious for us when we become ill. And dental work isn't going to be much fun either. They're still working with hot drills and Novocaine. Fluoride toothpastes haven't even come into being. That's another 20 years in the future.
On our side?
Bliss sputtered.
The communists? That's impossible. They've got that pact with the Nazis.
Germany will violate that pact, Joe said. Hitler will attack the Soviet Union in June 1941.
And wipe it out, I hope?
Startled out of his preoccupations, Joe turned to look closely at Mr. Bliss, driving his 9-year-old Willis Knight. Bliss said,
Those communists are the real menace, not the Germans. Take the treatment of the Jews. You know who makes a lot out of that? Jews in this country. A lot of them not citizens, but refugees living on public welfare. I think the Nazis certainly have been a little extreme in some of the things they've done to the Jews, but basically there's been the Jewish question for a long time. And something, although maybe not so vile as those concentration camps, had to be done about it. We have a similar problem here in the United States, both with Jews and with the niggers. Eventually we're going to have to do something about both.
I never actually heard the term nigger used, Joe said, and found himself appraising this era a little differently, all at once.
I forgot about this,
he realized.
Lindbergh is the one who's right about Germany,
Bliss said.
Have you ever listened to him speak? I don't mean what the newspapers write it up like, but actually...
He slowed the car to a stop for a semaphore-style stop signal.
Take Senator Bohr and Senator Nye. If it wasn't for them... Roosevelt would be selling munitions to England and getting us into a war that's not our war. Roosevelt is so darn interested in repealing the arms embargo clause of the neutrality bill. He wants us to get into the war. The American people aren't going to support him. The American people aren't interested in fighting England's war or anybody else's war.
The signal clanged and a green semaphore swung out. Bliss shifted into low gear and the Willis Knight bumbled forward, melding with downtown Des Moines midday traffic.
You're not going to enjoy the next 5 years,
Joe said.
Why not? The whole state of Iowa is behind me in what I believe. You know what I think about you employees, Mr. Runster? From what you said and from what those others said, what I overheard, I think you're professional agitators.
Bliss glanced at Joe with uncowed bravado. Joe said nothing. He watched the old-time brick and wood and concrete buildings go by, quaint cars, most of which appeared to be black, and wondered if he was the only one of the group who had been confronted by this particular aspect of the world of 1939.
In New York, he told himself, it'll be different. This is the Bible Belt. The isolationist Middle West. We won't be living here. We'll be on either the East Coast or the West.
But instinctively, he sensed that a major problem for all of them had exposed itself just now.
We know too much,
he realized,
to live comfortably in this time segment. If we had regressed 20 years or 30 years, we could probably make the psychological transition. It might not be interesting to once more live through the Gemini spacewalks and the creaking first Apollo flights, but at least it'd be possible. But at this point in time, they're still listening to 10-inch 78 records of Two Black Crows, and Joe Penner, and Mert and Marge. The Depression is still going on. In our time, we maintain colonies on Mars, on Luna. We're perfecting workable interstellar flight. These people have not been able to cope with the Dust Bowl of Oklahoma. This is a world that lives in terms of William Jennings Bryan's oratory. The Scopes monkey trial is a vivid reality here.
He thought,
there is no way we can adapt to their viewpoint, their moral, political, sociological environment. To them, we're professional agitators, more alien than the Nazis, probably even more of a menace than the Communist Party. We're the most dangerous agitators that this time segment has yet had to deal with. Bliss is absolutely right.
Where are you people from?
Bliss was asking.
Not from any part of the United States. Am I correct?
Joe said,
you're correct. We're from the North American Confederation.
From his pocket, he brought forth a Runciter quarter, which he handed to Bliss.
Be my guest, he said.
Glancing at the coin, Bliss gulped and quavered.
The profile in this coin, this is the deceased. This is Mr. Runciter.
He took another look and blanched.
And the date? 1990.
Don't spend it all in one place, Joe said.
When the Willis Knight reached the Simple Shepherd mortuary, the service had already ended. On the wide, white wooden steps of the two-story frame building, a group of people stood, and Joe recognized all of them. There, at last, they were. Edie Dorn, Tippi Jackson, John Ild, Francie Spanish, Tito Apostos, Don Denny, Sammy Mundo, Fred Zaski, and Pat.
My wife,
he said to himself, impressed once again by the sight of her, the dramatic dark hair, the intense coloring of her eyes and skin, all the powerful contrasts radiating from her.
No,
he said aloud as he stepped from the parked car.
She's not my wife. She wiped that out. But,
he remembered,
she kept the ring, the unique wrought silver and jade wedding ring which she and I picked out. That's all that remains. But what a shock to see her again. To regain, for an instant, the ghostly shroud of a marriage that has been abolished, that had, in fact, never existed, except for this ring. And, whenever she felt like it, she could obliterate the ring, too.
Hi, Joe Chip,
she said in her cool, almost mocking voice, her intense eyes fixed on him, appraising him.
Hello,
he said awkwardly. The others greeted him, too, but that did not seem so important. Pat had snared his attention.
No Al Hammond?
Don Denny asked. Joe said,
Al's dead. Wendy Wright is dead.
We know about Wendy,
Pat said, calmly.
No, we didn't know,
Don Denny said.
We assumed, but we weren't sure. I wasn't sure.
To Joe, he said,
What happened to them? What killed them?
They wore out.
Joe said.
Why?
Tito Apostos said hoarsely, crowding into the circle of people surrounding Joe. Pat Conley said,
The last thing you said to us, Joe Chip, back in New York, before you went off with Hammond.
I know what I said, Joe said.
Pat continued.
You said something about years. It had been too long, you said. What does that mean? Something about time.
Mr. Chip?
Edie Dorn said agitatedly.
Since we came here to this place, this town has radically changed.
None of us understand it. Do you see what we see?
With her hand, she indicated the mortuary building, then the street and the other buildings.
I'm not sure, Joe said, what it is you see.
Come on, Chip,
Tito Apostos said with anger.
Don't mess around. Simply tell us, for Christ's sake, what this place looks like to you. That vehicle.
He gestured toward the Willis Knight.
You arrived in that. Tell us what it is. Tell us what you arrived in.
They all waited, all of them intently watching Joe.
Mr. Chip,
Sammy Mundo stammered.
That's a real old automobile. That's what it is, right?
He giggled.
How old is it exactly?
After a pause, Joe said,
62 years old.
That would make it 1930,
Tippy Jackson said to Don Denny,
which is pretty close to what we figured.
We figured 1939,
Don Denny said to Joe in a level voice. A moderate, detached, mature, baritone voice, without undue emotionality, even under these circumstances. Joe said,
It's fairly easy to establish that. I took a look at a newspaper at my CONAP back in New York. September 12th, so today's September 13th, 1939. The French think they breached the Siegfried Line.
Which, in itself,
John Ild said,
is a million laughs.
I hoped, Joe said, that you as a group were experiencing a later reality. Well, so it goes.
If it's 1939, it's 1939,
Fred Zafsky said in a squeaky, high-pitched voice.
Naturally, we all experience it. What else can we do?
He flapped his long arms energetically, appealing to the others for their agreement.
Flirk off, Zafsky.
Tito Apostos said with annoyance. To Pat, Joe Chip said,
What do you say about this?
She shrugged.
Don't shrug, he said. Answer.
We've gone back in time,
Pat said.
Not really,
Joe said.
Then what have we done?
Pat said.
Gone forward in time, is that it?
Joe said,
We haven't gone anywhere. We're where we've always been. But for some reason, for one of several possible reasons, reality has receded. It's lost its underlying support, and it's ebbed back to previous forms. Forms it took 53 years ago. It may regress further. I'm more interested at this point in knowing if Runciter has manifested himself to you.
Runciter?
Don Denny said, this time with undue emotionality.
Is lying inside this building in his casket, dead as a herring. That's the only manifestation we've had of him, and that's the only one we're gonna get.
Does the word Ubik mean anything to you, Mr. Chip?
Francesca Spanish said. It took him a moment to absorb what she had said.
Jesus Christ,
he said then.
Can't you distinguish manifestations of...
Francie has dreams,
Tippy Jackson said.
She's always had them. Tell him your Ubik dream, Francie.
To Joe, she said,
Francie will now tell you her Ubik dream. As she calls it, she had it last night.
I call it that because that's what it is.
Francesca Spanish said fiercely. She clasped her hands together in a spasm of excited agitation.
Listen, Mr. Chip, it wasn't like any dream I've ever had before. A great hand came down from the sky, like the arm and hand of God. Enormous, the size of a mountain. And I knew at the time how important it was. The hand was closed, made into a rock-like fist, and I knew it contained something of value so great that my life and the lives of everyone else on Earth depended on it. And I waited for the fist to open, and it did open, and I saw what it contained.
An aerosol spray can,
Don Denny said dryly.
On the spray can,
Francesca Spanish continued,
there was one word, great golden letters glittering, golden fire, spelling out, Ubik. Nothing else. Just that strange word. And then the hand closed up again around the spray can, and the hand and arm disappeared, drawn back up into a sort of gray overcast. Today, before the funeral services, I looked in a dictionary, and I called the public library, but no one knew that word, or even what language it is, and it isn't in the dictionary. It isn't English, the librarian told me. There's a Latin word very close to it. Ubique. It means...
Everywhere, Joe said. Francesca Spanish nodded.
That's what it means. but no Yubik, and that's how it was spelled in the dream.
They're the same word, Joe said, just different spellings.
How do you know that?
Pat Conley said archly.
Runciter appeared to me yesterday, Joe said, in a taped TV commercial that he made before his death.
He did not elaborate. It seemed too complex to explain, at least at this particular time.
You miserable fool,
Pat Conley said to him.
Why? He asked.
Is that your idea of a manifestation of a dead man? You might as well consider letters he wrote before his death manifestations, or inner office memos that he transcribed over the years, or even...
Joe said,
I'm going inside and take a last look at Runciter.
He departed from the group, leaving them standing there, and made his way up the wide board steps and into the dark, cool interior of the mortuary. Emptiness. He saw no one, only a large chamber with pew-like rows of seats, and at the far end, a casket surrounded by flowers. Off in a small side room, an old-fashioned reed pump organ and a few wooden folding chairs. The mortuary smelled of dust and flowers, a sweet, stale mixture that repelled him.
Think of all the Iowans, he thought, who've embraced eternity in this listless room.
Varnished floors, handkerchiefs, heavy dark wool suits, everything but pennies placed over the dead eyes, and the organ playing symmetric little hymns. He reached the casket, hesitated, then looked down. A singed, dehydrated heap of bones lay at one end of the casket, culminating in a paper-like skull that leered up at him, the eyes recessed like dried grapes. Tatters of cloth with bristle-like woven spines had collected near the tiny body, as if blown there by wind. As if the body, breathing, had cluttered itself with them by its wheezing, meager processes, inhalation and exhalation, which had now ceased. Nothing stirred. The mysterious change, which had also degraded Wendy Wright and Al, had reached its end, evidently a long time ago.
Years ago,
he thought, remembering Wendy. Had the others in the group seen this, or had it happened since the services? Joe reached out, took hold of the oak lid of the casket, and shut it. The thump of wood against wood echoed throughout the empty mortuary, but no one heard it. No one appeared. Blinded by tears of fright, he made his way back out of the dust-stricken, silent room, back into the weak sunlight of late afternoon.
What's the matter?
Don Denny asked him as he rejoined the group. Joe said,
Nothing.
You look scared out of your goony wits,
Pat Conley said acutely.
Nothing.
He stared at her with deep, infuriated hostility. Tippy Jackson said to him,
While you're in there, did you by any chance happen to see Edie Dorn?
She's missing,
John Ild said by way of explanation.
But she was just out here, Joe protested.
All day she's been saying she felt terribly cold and tired,
Don Denny said.
It may be that she went back to the hotel. She said something about it earlier, that she wanted to lie down and take a nap right after the services. She's probably all right.
Joe said, She's probably dead. To all of them, he said,
I thought you understood. If any one of us gets separated from the group, he won't survive. What happened to Wendy and Al and Runciter?
He broke off.
Runciter was killed in the blast,
Don Denny said.
We were all killed in the blast, Joe said. I know that because Runciter told me. He wrote it on the wall of the men's room back at our New York offices, and I saw it again on...
What you're saying is insane,
Pat Conley said sharply, interrupting him.
Is Runciter dead or isn't he? Are we dead or aren't we? First you say one thing, then you say another. Can't you be consistent?
Try to be consistent,
John Ild put in. The others, their faces pinched and creased with worry, nodded in mute agreement. Joe said,
I can tell you what the graffiti said. I can tell you about the worn-out tape recorder, the instructions that came with it. I can tell you about Runciter's TV commercial, the note in the carton of cigarettes in Baltimore. I can tell you about the label on the flask of Elixir of Ubique. But I can't make it all add up. In any case, we have to get you to your hotel to try to reach Edie Dorn before she withers away and irreversibly expires.
Where can we get a taxi?
The mortuary has provided us with a car to use while we're here,
Don Denning said.
That Piercero sitting over there.
He pointed. They hurried toward it.
We're not all of us going to be able to fit in, Tippy Jackson said as Don Denny tugged the solid iron door open and got inside.
Ask Blisk if we can take the Willis Knight, Joe said. He started up the engine of the Piercero, and as soon as everyone possible had gotten into the car, drove out onto the busy main street of Des Moines.
The Willis Knight followed close behind, its horn honking dolefully to tell Joe it was there. 12.
Pop tasty Ubik into your toaster, made only from fresh fruit and healthful all-vegetable shortening. Ubik makes breakfast a feast, puts zing into your thing. Safe when handled as directed.
One by one,
Joe Chip said to himself as he piloted the big car through traffic.
We're succumbing.
Something's wrong with my theory. Edie, by being with the group, should have been immune. And I? It should have been me, he thought, sometime during my slow flight from New York.
What we'll have to do, he said to Don Denny, is make sure that anyone who feels tired, that seems to be the first warning, tells the rest of us and isn't allowed to wander away.
Twisting around to face those in the back seat, Don said,
Did you all hear that? As soon as any of you feels tired, even a little bit, report it to either Mr. Chip or myself.
He turned back toward Joe.
And then what?
He asked.
And then what, Joe?
Pat Conley echoed.
What do we do then? Tell us how we do it, Joe. We're listening.
Joe said to her,
It seems strange to me that your talent isn't coming into play. This situation appears to me to be made for it. Why can't you go back 15 minutes and compel Edie Dorn not to wander off? Do what you did when I first introduced you to Runciter.
Gigi Ashwood introduced me to Mr. Runciter, Pat said.
So you're not going to do anything, Joe said.
Sammy Mundo giggled and said,
They had a fight last night while we were eating dinner. Miss Conley and Miss Dorn. Miss Conley doesn't like her. That's why she won't help.
I liked Edie, Pat said.
Do you have any reason for not making use of your talent?
Don Denny asked her.
Joe's right. It's very strange and difficult to understand, at least for me, why exactly you don't try to help.
After a pause, Pat said,
My talent doesn't work anymore. It hasn't since the bomb blast on Luna.
Why didn't you say so?
Joe said. Pat said,
I didn't feel like saying so, goddammit. Why should I volunteer information like that, that I can't do anything? I keep trying and it keeps not working. Nothing happens. And it's never been that way before. I've had the talent virtually my entire life.
When did?
Joe began.
With Runciter, Pat said. On Luna, right away. Before you asked me.
So you knew that long ago, Joe said.
I tried again in New York after you showed up from Zurich and it was obvious that something awful had happened to Wendy. And I've been trying now. I started as soon as you said Edie was probably dead. Maybe it's because we're back in this archaic time period. Maybe psionic talents don't work in 1939. But that wouldn't explain Luna, unless we'd already traveled back here and we didn't realize it.
She lapsed into brooding, introverted silence. Dully, she gazed out at the streets of Des Moines, a bitter expression on her potent, wild face.
It fits in, Joe said to himself.
Of course, her time-traveling talent no longer functions. This is not really 1939, and we are outside of time entirely. This proves that Al was right. The graffiti was right. This is half-life, as the couplets told us.
He did not, however, say this to the others with him in the car.
Why tell them it's hopeless? He said to himself. They're going to find it out soon enough. The smarter ones, such as Denny, probably understand it already. Based on what I've said and what they themselves have gone through.
This really bothers you,
Don Denny said to him.
That her talent no longer works.
Sure, he nodded. I hoped it might change the situation.
There's more,
Denny said with acute intuition.
I can tell by your,
he gestured,
tone of voice, maybe. Anyhow, I know. This means something. It's important. It tells you something.
Do I keep going straight here?
Joe said, slowing the Pierce Arrow at an intersection.
Turn right,
Tippy Jackson said. Pat said,
you'll see a brick building with a neon sign going up and down. The Miramon Hotel, it's called. A terrible place. One bathroom for every two rooms, and a tub instead of a shower. And the food? Oh, incredible. And the only drink they sell is something called knee-high.
I like the food,
Don Denny said.
Genuine cow meat, rather than protein synthetics. Authentic salmon?
Is your money good? Joe asked. And then he heard a high-pitched whine echoing up and down the street behind him.
What's that mean?
He asked Denny.
I don't know,
Denny said nervously.
Sammy Mundo said, it's a police siren. You didn't give a signal before you turned.
How could I?
Joe said. There's no lever on the steering column.
You should have made a hand signal,
Sammy said. The siren had become very close now. Joe, turning his head, saw a motorcycle pulling up abreast with him. He slowed the car, uncertain as to what he should do.
Stop at the curb,
Sammy advised him. Joe stopped the car at the curb. Stepping from his motorcycle, the cop strolled up to Joe, a young, rat-faced man with hard, large eyes. He studied Joe and then said,
let me see your license, mister.
I don't have one, Joe said. Make out the ticket and let us go. He could see the hotel now. To Don Denny, he said,
you better get over there, you and everyone else.
The Willis Knight continued on toward it. Don Denny, Pat, Sammy Mundo, and Tippy Jackson abandoned the car. They trotted after the Willis Knight, which had begun to slow to a stop across from the hotel, leaving Joe to face the cop alone. The cop said to Joe,
do you have any identification?
Joe handed him his wallet. With a purple, indelible pencil, the cop wrote out a ticket, tore it from his pad, and passed it to Joe.
Failure to signal. No operator's license. The citation tells where and when to appear.
The cop slapped his ticket book shut, handed Joe his wallet, then sauntered back to his motorcycle. He revved up his motor and then zoomed out into traffic without looking back. For some obscure reason, Joe glanced over the citation before putting it away in his pocket and read it once again, slowly. In purple, indelible pencil, the familiar scrawled handwriting said, you are in much greater danger than I thought. What Pat Conley said is... There, the message ceased, in the middle of a sentence. He wondered how it would have continued. Was there anything more on the citation? He turned it over, found nothing, returned again to the front side. No further handwriting, but in squirrel agate type at the bottom of the slip of paper, the following inscription. Try Archer's Drugstore for reliable household remedies and medicinal preparations of tried and tested value, economically priced.
Not much to go on,
Joe reflected. But still, not what should have appeared at the bottom of a Des Moines traffic citation. It was clearly another manifestation, as was the purple handwriting above it. Getting out of the Pierce Arrow, he entered the nearest store, a magazine, candy, and tobacco supply shop.
May I use your phone book?
He asked the broad-beamed, middle-aged proprietor.
In the rear,
the proprietor said amiably with a jerk of his heavy thumb. Joe found the phone book and in the dim recesses of the dark little store looked up Archer's Drugstore. He could not find it listed. Closing the phone book, he approached the proprietor, who at the moment was engaged in selling a roll of Necco wafers to a boy.
Do you know where I can find Archer's Drugstore?
Joe asked him.
Nowhere,
the proprietor said.
At least not anymore.
Why not?
It's been closed for years,
Joe said.
Tell me where it was, anyhow. Draw me a map.
You don't need a map. I can tell you where it was.
The big man leaned forward, pointing out the door of his shop.
You see that barber pole there? Go over there and then look north. That's north.
He indicated the direction.
You'll see an old building with gables, yellow in color. There's a couple of apartments over it still being used, but the store premises downstairs, they're abandoned. You'll be able to make out the sign, though. Archer's Drugs. So you know when you found it. What happened is that Ed Archer came down with throat cancer and...
Thanks, Joe said, and started out of the store, back into the pale mid-afternoon sunlight. He walked rapidly across the street to the barber pole, and from that position looked due north. He could see the tall, peeling yellow building at the periphery of his range of vision. But something about it struck him as strange, a shimmer, an unsteadiness, as if the building faded forward into stability and then retreated into insubstantial uncertainty. An oscillation, each phase lasting a few seconds and then blurring off into its opposite, a fairly regular variability, as if an organic pulsation underlay the structure. As if, he thought, it's alive.
Maybe, he thought, I've come to the end.
He began to walk toward the abandoned drugstore, not taking his eyes from it. He watched it pulse. He watched it change between its two states. And then, as he got closer and closer to it, he discerned the nature of its alternate conditions. At the amplitude of greater stability, it became a retail home art outlet of his own time period. Homeostatic in operation, a self-service enterprise selling 10,000 commodities for the modern Connapt. He had patronized such highly functional, computer-controlled pseudo-merchants throughout his adult life. And, at the amplitude of insubstantiality, it resolved itself into a tiny, anachronistic drugstore with rococo ornamentation. In its meager window displays, he saw hernia belts, rows of corrective eyeglasses, a mortar and pestle, jars of assorted tablets, a hand-printed sign reading leeches, huge glass-stoppered bottles that contained a Pandora's heritage of patent medicines and placebos, and, painted on a flat wood board running across the top of the windows, the words Archer's Drugstore. No sign whatever of an empty, abandoned, closed-up store. Its 1939 stage had somehow been excluded. He thought,
so in entering it, I either revert further, or I find myself back roughly in my own time. And it's the further reversion, the pre-1939 phase, that I evidently need.
Presently he stood before it, experiencing physically the tidal tug of the amplitudes. He felt himself drawn back, then ahead, then back again. Pedestrians clumped by, taking no notice. Obviously, none of them saw what he saw. They perceived neither Archer's drugstore nor the 1992 home art outlet. That mystified him most of all. As the structure swung directly into its ancient phase, he stepped forward, crossed the threshold, and entered Archer's drugstore. To the right, a long marble-topped counter, boxes on the shelves, dingy in color. The whole store had a black quality to it, not merely in regard to the absence of light, but rather a protective coloration, as if it had been constructed to blend, to merge with shadows, to be at all times opaque. It had a heavy, dense quality. It pulled him down, weighing on him like something installed permanently on his back. And it had ceased to oscillate, at least for him, now that he had entered it. He wondered if he had made the right choice. Now, too late, he considered the alternative, what it might have meant. A return, possibly, to his own time. Out of this devolved world of constantly declining time-binding capacity. Out, perhaps, forever.
Well, he thought, so it goes.
He wandered about the drugstore, observing the brass and the wood, evidently walnut. He came at last to the prescription window at the rear. A wispy young man, wearing a gray, many-buttoned suit with vest, appeared and silently confronted him. For a long time, Joe and the man looked at each other, neither speaking. The only sound came from a wall clock with Latin numerals on its round face. Its pendulum ticked back and forth inexorably. After the fashion of clocks. Everywhere. Joe said,
I'd like a jar of Ubik.
The salve?
The druggist said. His lips did not seem properly synchronized with his words. First, Joe saw the man's mouth open, the lips move, and then, after a measurable interval, he heard the words.
Is it a salve?
Joe said.
I thought it was for internal use.
The druggist did not respond for an interval, as if a gulf separated the two of them, an epoch of time. Then, at last, his mouth again opened, his lips again moved, and presently, Joe heard words.
Ubik has undergone many alterations as the manufacturer has improved it. You may be familiar with the old Ubik,
rather than the new.
The druggist turned to one side, and his movement had a stop-action quality. He flowed in a slow, measured, dance-like step, and aesthetically